Namaste. Good morning, everyone. Someone had sent me a quotation of Rumi, the Persian poet, and asked what my thoughts were about it. I'll read it out first. And I'm no expert on Rumi's works, but this quotation to me has tremendous relevance in the teaching of Advaita. So I can explain it from that perspective. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I will meet you there. Out beyond ideas of rightdoing and wrongdoing, there is a field. You see, this represents the polarities of right and wrong. And we find, by and large, we are polarized. Either we feel we are right or we are wrong. Generally, we feel we are right. Or we feel the other is generally wrong or right. Now, the teaching of Advaita is an invitation to look at this in a fresh perspective. That what I consider right, if I feel I am doing the right thing or saying the right thing, as against the other who I feel is saying the wrong thing. You see, this brings to my awareness that what I consider is right is based on some very limiting factors. It is based on my intellect, understanding, which in turn is based on my conditioning, on my genetics, on my very specific conditioning. Since childhood, this conditioning shapes me. This conditioning makes me view the world in a certain way and view people's actions in a certain way. And therefore, on the basis of that, I pass judgment. I could well be wrong in that sense because someone else with a different set of conditioning and nature may not react the same way as I react to a given situation. When I understand this, something very beautiful happens. I may still feel I'm right about something and the other is wrong, but there is no longer resistance and opposition to the fact that the other person's view is different from mine. This removes the thorn in relationships. I no longer get agitated or upset beyond a point, perhaps, because I am no longer identified strongly with my view. I still have it, but I don't force it on another. I don't try to convince them all the time. I say what I have to say, and then I let things flow. So what is this field which Rumi is pointing to, which is beyond right doing and wrong doing? I will meet you there. Basically, it means rising above the pairs of opposites, understanding that that is the nature of life and the structure of life as we know it. Duality. Opposites means duality. And it is this understanding which, in a given situation, when it is there, when two people meet and don't agree on a certain point, the one with the understanding is still receptive and open enough to say, all right, we don't see eye to eye on this. Let's move on. Let's perhaps go and have a coffee together. There's so much more we can share beyond this point. That is the field of presence, one could say. Because when my thinking mind, when the thinking mind of the ego is not churning the incident all the time and refreshing it, bringing what is now the dead past alive all the time, when my thinking mind is quiet, all there is the sense of presence, which is the field. Now, there are certain acts, one could say, which are clearly wrong in the larger picture. Let's say someone is abusing you, as one example. This does not mean a passivity. It does not mean holding oneself back, all it means is we don't know where this person is coming from. We don't know their conditioning. We don't know how they were treated by their parents and so on and so forth, which makes them say certain things and do certain things. So when that is in operation, I find that I perhaps respond rather than react to the situation. Choices come up in front of me, whereas earlier I might be mired in this action-reaction loop. That is what we call in India seeing through the eye of wisdom, the single eye, the eye of singularity, the dawn of wisdom. Now, this field is not just there as far as the polarities of right doing and wrong doing are concerned. It is basically there when we understand all polarities. Pleasure and pain is one example. When we understand that life will not give me pleasure all the time, my own experience is pleasure sometimes, pain sometimes. Maybe pleasure rarely, pain most of the time, because that is the nature of life. It is transient. Then it means I am no longer polarized and demanding and expecting life to give me one pleasure after another. That is why Maharaj said, what comes unasked from the universe, it is what is meant for you, pleasure or pain. So the sage understands that suffering happens when we are stuck on one polarity. Because when we are stuck on that, for example, anyone would want pleasure compared to pain. But when we are stuck on that and then try to force outcomes to give us pleasure, we create suffering for ourselves and others. When we have the humility to accept that our point of view is simply a point of view and not the truth, then we find that we are more and more at peace through the journey of life. But that also requires humility to know that perhaps a particular relationship, which I have been viewing for so long, I have been viewing it from a very limited perspective, because the ego is not willing to relinquish its position easily. That willingness creates a turning point on one's journey, what Goldsmith would refer to as being unselfed. Whatever I consider precious, me and mine, my views, my opinions, my judgments, is no longer that precious anymore. So I am being unselfed. All right. That's what I felt like sharing. And if anyone would like to ask any questions or share anything in light of the teaching, then I would request you to raise your hand and I will then invite you to speak. Yes, Renko.
Hello, Gautam. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Thank you. We are talking for the first time, probably, I think. And I am very grateful for the satsangs and talking and everything. And I want to ask, some people pushes its view no matter what, until the point of a quarrel. And that is their conditioning. They cannot help with that. And I'm in a situation, I have to cooperate with them. I have to make mutual tasks with them, making decisions even together. And it seems impossible. So what do you think, what is the best attitude in that situation?
It's a question which comes up often, Renko, and it is certainly a tough situation to be in. You see, because I'll give you one example. Recently, someone told me a father and son relationship. They have been trying for a very long time to get along, maybe 15 years, and they don't see eye to eye. Now the son is fed up of trying because he feels his life is going by. He has understood the teaching. He has accepted that the father is playing out his script. Nothing they have tried, no reasoning has worked. Now has come the point where he is looking at options which he never considered before. For example, the option of telling his father that, look, let's accept we can't get along. Now, his fear in this case is he might lose the inheritance. You see? But this option, which was not thought of before, due to the circumstances, due to the fact that no matter what the son brings to the situation in terms of understanding the father, the dynamic is not changing. So earlier, it was inconceivable for him to even think that he could exercise the option that perhaps the inheritance will not come his way. And he is now pondering whether it's really worth going through suffering in order to get the inheritance. That is his situation. But if you can see that the objectivity which this teaching brings, it opens up certain dimensions. Now, you may be in a situation where there are no options which are coming in front of you. Sometimes we are trapped in a specific situation we can't get out of. It is easy to say that sometimes the best thing is to walk away. All this teaching does is holds your hand while you go through this situation. When you see that this is an act of God, you are, you know, what we call, what Shirdi Sai Baba calls hardwired rinanubandhan. There are certain relationships which are really hardwired. They are our greatest teachers. What you are describing could be one such relationship. And all this teaching says is that when we see this relationship in this light, that no one is the doer of their actions, all that happens is what was simple imprisonment in this equation, we don't convert to rigorous imprisonment by the thinking mind blaming, condemning, judging, hating, and so on and so forth. Now, whether it is your destiny that an opening is found, something changes, that God knows. But this teaching creates the ground for that possibility. That is my understanding of it.
Yeah, it's strange that you bring that example of son and father, because that is my life situation. I had that situation with my father, and I wasn't interested in heritage and stuff like that. But it seems like this question is going through all my life.
Yes.
Probably yeah. It is some lesson in it I have to learn.
You see, while you are hoping to learn that lesson, and there may be a lesson, there always is. We do not know what it is, perhaps. The lesson, Renko, is this, that every time we blame the other, we are reincarnating into the same relationship, the same dynamic. Every time we get involved with the thinking mind, with criticism and judgment and blame, that is what is extending our own suffering. Then our psychological suffering in the situation is being enhanced. And this teaching is a balm for that. But sometimes, and I have mentioned this not too often, because I do feel that one should try one's best to work through a relationship situation, through the relationship and not escape it. But sometimes we find that it's not going to work. And then we try to tell that person, look, we've tried long enough. Let's now agree that we can't make it work out. No one is to blame. And let's see if we can get along on other issues and other aspects. All we can do is try. Results are never in our control, will never be in our control. But what happens is, to reiterate the point, I can look at the same relationship in a different way and ask myself, is there any scope to continue this relationship beyond this struggle and this particular topic maybe which has exasperated it. Do I like this person's inherent nature except for this problem? So that kind of investigation can go on for oneself. That is an allowing rather than shutting all the doors, you see. That is what happens. And if it comes to the situation where there is no hope, you will be surprised to find that you still wish the person well. All right, it didn't work out, but I wish you well on your journey of life. Who would want to wish someone else pain and suffering, really? Because when we've seen enough, we know how difficult that burden is to carry. So deep down, the people we don't get along with, the people we don't see eye to eye with, we also wish them well. That may your boat float across the waters of life gently. We didn't get along. It was not our destiny to. So be it. We tried our best. I tried my best. That's all I could have done.
Yeah, the main point is actually the blame. Blaming people is the main issue.
Yes.
You have to see.
Yes. That is this whole point of right doing and wrong doing.
Yeah. This is very helpful.
Thank you, Renko. Which part of the world are you in?
Croatia.
Croatia.
Okay. Former Yugoslavia, if you know.
Yes, yes. Okay, thank you. Yes, Sai Ganesh, is it?
Yes. Namaste, Guru. So, my question is, I think you are aware that Ramana Maharshi said you can concentrate or put your attention on the self even while you are working. In your day-to-day activities or in your profession. I find it easy to do in the mundane physical activities, like automatic activities such as cleaning something or, you know, these physical things. But when my mind comes, then the trouble starts. So I can't put my complete attention on the self because I have to do certain mental calculations, certain plannings, where my ego will rise. So how to tackle this and how to move forward from there?
You see, it's not about the ego rising when you're doing a calculation. When you are doing a calculation, the working mind is being fully engaged. And the working mind is not the problem. It is the thinking mind which is the problem. So now, for example, Bhagwan said, whenever you are working, tell yourself, I am not doing the work, but rather it is the current doing the work through me. So what he was doing was taking away the sense of doership of I am doing the work. Now, there's no question of wanting to keep one half of one's attention on the self and one half on the work. When the working mind is operating in pristine purity, then the thinking mind of the ego with its sense of doership is not operating. And that is the problem. Then you are 100% at work. Because then there's no sense of doership that I am doing the work, you see. But supposing you find yourself saying, oh, I worked so hard today. I'm so tired. I did this. I did that. Then Bhagwan is saying, hey, hold on. Take a look at that. You have been gifted attributes, your nature, which has allowed the work to happen through you. It is this claiming this work as mine, I did it, which is tiresome and burdensome. There may be physical tiredness if I'm engaged in a certain activity, or even mental tiredness if it's a lot of mind-related work. But still, as long as the working mind is functioning in pristine purity, that is absolutely fine. The problem is when the ego is claiming ownership of doing that work. That is when the difficulty comes in. You see, because this reminder of his is actually quite beautiful for someone who's embroiled in work. For example, just as an example, even if you set an alarm every 1 hour for your, if you're at work for 6 hours or 8 hours, just as a reminder that, hey, just step back. Who is doing the work? You know, it recalibrates, especially a person who has so far thought, I am the doer, I am doing this, I am working hard. It's like a recalibration. And then you'll be surprised that you find that when my thinking mind, which is the ego with its sense of doership, is not operating anymore when I am working, my work is turning out to be more and more efficient, because the ego with its sense of doership is not only claiming the work as its own, but is generally found to be in the dead past or an imaginary future, full of either regrets of the past or hopes and fears for the future. In the present moment, when the work is being done, when the working mind is engaged, most definitely, the mind will pull its experience from the past years in order to do the right thing according to what it considers is the best way to do the work. But that is still the working mind. But when that mind gets lost in a story, then we have shifted from the working mind to the thinking mind. If we live with this understanding more and more, that all actions that I thought I was doing are actually happening through me, then we will start realizing what Bhagwan is pointing to. Does that help you in any way?
Yes, it very much helped me. Thank you very much. And can you tell me any warning signs when this working mind is shifted to this thinking mind? So how to find that and how to recalibrate myself?
When you find that your attention is now fragmented, when you find, oh God, I'm not giving 100% to the work anymore, my mind drifted, then automatically you will know that the thinking mind was in operation. Nothing needs to be done. Or when you find that you are working about something, thinking something else about, I have to call this friend in the evening, I have to go here, I have to go there, automatically the understanding comes that the mind was drifting. You see, so all this does is shines a light of awareness. There's nothing really to be done to stay in that present moment, because that doing itself is what is taking you away from it, you see. So this is, for example, even in meditation, what happens, say you want to sit for half an hour and you find that at some point your mind drifted, something came up about yesterday or something you have to do tomorrow, and suddenly the awareness comes that my mind drifted. So it is the awareness which cuts off the involvement. You don't have to do it, because then that creates more effort and a further sense of doership, that now I must be very attentive so that my mind does not drift. That can be quite stressful, actually. That is why my teacher would say, the seeing is the only doing necessary. To see the way the mind works, how it moves, how it drifts, and just to be aware, that awareness brings it back to the center point. Okay?
Yeah. Thank you very much, Guru. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Would anyone else like to ask anything? I'm just getting used to this screen since so much time has passed. Yes, I can see. Yes, Latha.
Namaste, sir.
Namaste.
From the non-dual perspective, when Sri Ramana was asked, how do we treat others? He said, there are no others. So in this time-bound, space-bound, dual world, how do I understand this teaching? Like, is everything I see outside, is it the reflection of my own mind? So when I see something wrong outside, does it mean, since there are no others, is it just a reflection of my own self? Like, how do I understand this teaching that there are no others?
So, in fact, I just gave a talk on this very statement of Bhagwan's in Delhi. And that video, I think, is up on the channel. So what we could do is send you the link. It addresses this issue completely, hopefully.
Okay.
And you would get your answers. But yes, one thing is true, Latha, that the others bring out what is within us. So let's say if someone is pushing my buttons and something arises, I feel angry or I feel disgust or whatever it may be, whatever the emotion is, The point is that that is within me only.
Okay.
That is just has been given an opportunity to come up onto the surface, you see.
Okay.
That is why Maharaj would say that if we live with this understanding that nobody is really speaking to us as individuals, but just consciousness is speaking through everyone, we would find our relationships are quite different because we assign different people, put labels on them, this one I like, this one I don't like, this one I hate, and then judge them from that perspective. Because we see others as bodies, as he would say, this is what tends to happen. But when we really live with this understanding that the same consciousness flows through everyone, bringing about whatever that instrument is bringing about, then you can say our view becomes in that sense impersonal. That is what Goldsmith refers to as our relationship no longer being with people, but our relationship being with God. Because now we are living this understanding that all the people in my life whom I have relationships with have been shaped by the same creator in different ways, no doubt. In different ways. Some love me, some trouble me.
Okay.
Right? When I live with this understanding, it brings a sense of neutrality in my relationships with others.
Okay.
And when I see that the hand of God makes me say what I say and do what I do, if I see flaws in others and imperfections, I realize I too have my own imperfections, perhaps based on my conditioning, which I didn't create, then compassion arises for people and for myself. And by and by, this realization comes that there actually are no others in that sense, as I thought they were. Of course, in manifestation, I'm dealing with other people, I'm dealing with other bodies, but I find my relationship with them, with this understanding that there are no others, but only consciousness, speaking through some people, listening through other people, then I start living Bhagwan's statement of there are no others.
So here the concept of non-doership comes in, right? So
it absolutely is just
life expressing itself in one way through me and in another way through others. And there should be no judgment of what is how the life expresses through them. So you stop judging others, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. You still may act, you see. You may still take certain decisions and feel that, you know, I want to express myself to this person, or maybe I'm best not meeting this person, whatever it be. But, you know, your approach now is more of so be it. Because that blame game, that finger pointing is now history.
Okay.
So it does not mean that one takes a back seat in that sense. What we find with this understanding is that every time my peace of mind was shaken up in certain relationships, that is no longer happening now.
Okay.
Because I am understanding my relationship to the other in the light of the teaching. Now it's making more and more sense to me, this whole game of relationships.
Okay.
And I'm seeing it in that light. Then that sense, I realize there are no others. So this is a summary of what I spoke about in Delhi. But if you can look at that talk, then that would perhaps be more helpful.
Yeah, sure, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Sarthak. Have I pronounced your name properly? Sarthak.
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 Yes.
Yes, Sarthak.
Gaurav, it's really nice to be with you here today. It's my first time asking you a question. And my question was around non-doership. So I've really like settled into the idea of me not being the doer. But there's this one flip-flop that happens, as Ramesh would say, is I find there's this loss of doing any action that is unnecessary, if you feel me. So unless it's very necessary, that's only when I'm going to do it. And I find there's a sense that comes up, am I losing out on making more actions happen due to lack of motivation? What are your thoughts of this?
See, this lack of motivation is the crux of your question. You know what this teaching says, Sarthak? Now, you know, there are some people who are oriented to action. I know some people who can do 10 things in the course of the day. I can't do it, right? This teaching says that that is the way the person is designed. If the person's nature is to do things, to be very active, go here, go there, they are honoring their nature when they understand I am not the doer. It's not changing their nature. If one's nature was more of, you know, let's say a degree of passivity, and one realized one was caught up in the drama of life too much, and one was moving away from one's nature because of the force of life, then one finds one is now resting back into what one's nature was. Now, in your case, which of the two is it? One is that I loved doing things. I was a doer. With this understanding, it is clear that now I know I'm not the doer, but I still love doing things with this understanding. So I'm true to my nature in that sense. The other is this was not really my nature. It became my conditioning. My preference is, in fact, to not do as much as I was doing. Then you're honoring this nature, which was your true nature. So there's no right and wrong. This understanding says that either way, it does not say don't act. If action is true to you, please go ahead knowing that you are not the doer. And you will find in the flip-flop that maybe out of 10 actions, 5, they just started happening and you'd rather not have done them. So you go through a kind of filtration process and a calibration process which creates the flip-flop. It's actually quite beautiful because even this phase of thinking, am I becoming passive, is what is meant to be. Because for the first time, the ego is questioning its actions. Earlier, it was a default mode. You know, I was like just programmed like a doll, which is wound up and I'm going tuck, 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 tuck. So now I'm looking at everything like, hey, is this really what I want to be doing? Is this what I feel I should be doing? So I'm reinvestigating that. And that can appear to me as being more passive. But most importantly, the defining question is, am I more at peace or not? If I find my peace is in doing less, so be it. But I may find that, no, my nature, my mind is going crazy because I love doing things. And in fact, when I'm doing 10 things, I'm more at peace. Could be. We don't know. The criteria is peace of mind, sukha shanti. There will be a person who does many things during the day and is more at peace than the person who doesn't do.
That makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Sai, how do you pronounce your name?
Yeah, it is Sai Gautam. Good morning. Sai. Can you hear me?
Yes. How are you?
I'm doing good, Gautam. Thanks. So last Sunday, you were in Bangalore. I could meet you in person.
Yes.
I feel so privileged and blessed to have seen you in person. Thanks for coming to Bangalore. I hope you will again come back here soon.
Yes, I really enjoyed Bangalore and I hope I'm back soon too.
Yes, Gautam. Thanks for your visit here. So I think during your talk last Sunday, you had mentioned one quote from Gorakhnath. That, you know, I don't remember it exactly, but probably it goes on these lines of Jo bin mangi mila wo dood.
I can say it for you because it's gone into my blood.
Yeah. If you could please.
For the sake of everyone.
Yes.
Sahaj mila so dood barabar. Sahaj mila so dood barabar. Mang liya so pani. Khinch liya so rakt barabar. Gorakh bole bani. Sahaj mila so doodh barabar. What comes naturally, unasked, is what is meant for you. It is like getting milk. Mang liya so pani. When you ask, It is like getting water. Khinch liya, so rakt barabar. Khinch liya is when you snatch or even when you take what is not yours from others. It is like getting blood. Thus speaks Gorakhnath. Now to me, this couplet represents the three levels of doership. Extreme doership, mild doership, and non-doership. I think the entire teaching of Advaita is summed up in this verse. So go on.
Yeah, I think my thought around this quotation was, you know, pain usually comes unasked for. It is usually unasked thing that you get through pain. And in that context of what Gorakhnath has said, that, you know, what is unasked for is something like milk, to get milk. How do you correlate getting milk versus, you know, getting a pain which is unasked for? Because normally what happens is in the process of getting the pain or experiencing the pain, a lot happens to the human body. For example, I myself had a situation where I was medically down for more than 2 years, and that pain was quite unbearable, to say the least.
Of course.
Even now, I'm not completely out of the pain process. It's been more than 2 years. And there doesn't seem to be any cure for this ailment that I'm coming, that I have currently in myself. So that pain has been quite unbearable, to say the least. But the thing is, in terms of this teaching, how do I see myself positioned right now? And how do I deal with it, basically, going forward?
You see, Gorakhnath does not mean that if you don't ask, only good things will come your way. What he means is, what comes unasked is what is meant for you. What comes unasked is what is meant for you. Now, this what is meant for you is very hard to accept when we are going through suffering, because we question God, why me? Why did you do this to me?
Yeah.
It is natural, right? What have I done wrong? And this is where my teacher would say that you will never get answers to these why questions. Why questions will create more questions. What happens with the understanding is these why questions dissolve. When I have a total acceptance of the will of God, it may not take away my physical suffering, but it will certainly take away the mental anguish which I was going through. Because I was blaming myself, I was blaming God, I was blaming the doctors, whatever it is. So, therefore, Gorakhnath's statement has deep relevance here. Because I didn't ask for this pain, as you so rightly said. But what he is pointing to is it came unasked. And here the point is that earlier, while I was getting so lost in this blame game of life, now that is no longer happening. I am suffering the pain. I have to. That is my lot. It is not going to mitigate the physical pain. But because I find a total acceptance of the condition, including the fact that I'm sad about it, and it makes me low sometimes, there's a total acceptance of that also. You see, that is the beauty of this teaching. Nothing is rejected. This teaching doesn't say, oh, you know, you are to blame, you should think positively, you should do this, you should do that. It doesn't go into that zone. All it says is that, all right, in your blueprint, let's say there's more suffering than in someone else's. So be it. A total acceptance of this is the healing balm. Now, my teacher would say that whenever you feel like this, think of people who are suffering to a far higher degree than you are. And then maybe gratitude to God would arise. But many people objected to this approach of his, because they would say, no, the one who's suffering knows how much they are suffering. They are not concerned with other people and their suffering. You see, because what also tends to happen is, because there's pain, it brings the spotlight back onto oneself and onto one's pain. Now, Joel Goldsmith had a very radical approach. You see, he said that every time we pull this focus back to our problem, our physical situation, we are spotlighting the me again. And he would quote Jesus and Jesus's teachings. My kingdom is not of this world and all that. So the spotlight was being moved away from the me. Now, this is also what tends to happen with pain. You know, it brings the spotlight back onto my pain, my suffering, what I am going through. And the greatest masters, like even the mother of Pondicherry, you know, she would say that don't focus on the pain anymore. Just maybe think of other things or whatever it is. Because we get obsessed with that as being mine. Yes, this is all easier said than done. But sahaj mila so doodh barabar, I'm going back to Maharaj's statement, which I mentioned earlier. What comes unasked is what is meant for you. Why? As my teacher would say, a painting can never know why its painter painted it. So you will find that the why questions start dissolving.
Yes, Gautam. Yeah. So essentially what it means that is that the new normal that I'm currently facing or grappling with in terms of my medical condition has to be accepted completely, totally. And then maybe see the way forward from what I think the best can be done in this case.
Yes, and all your feelings about it too are legitimate and have to be accepted so that the suffering is not multiplied. You see,
so this also brings about a change in the way I currently lead my daily life also, right? It's a big change for me in terms of what I used to do earlier and what I'm currently doing, just to get things done from my normal perspective as well. So there's a big change in terms of what happens around me, around my family also here. That's a big challenge that currently is facing me.
No, so I guess absolutely. No, and whatever I say would sound, you know, like easier said than done. I can fully understand what you're going through. You know, because even one small physical problem sets one back.
Absolutely.
One is not free anymore. So it is a limitation. It is certainly a limitation. That is why Maharaj said we are limited by the space of a body and by the volume of a body and the space of a lifetime. Something to that effect. We have been brought into limitation. And we suffer the pains of limitation. All this teaching does is tries to take away the psychological suffering which gets added on to the basic suffering.
Yeah. Thank you, Gautam. Thank you.
I wish you all the best with your health condition.
Thanks, Gautam. Thank you so much.
Yes, sir. Is that Suli?
Yes.
Hello.
Hello. Gautam, since I have known you, since I have first listened to your talks on YouTube, I have tried to listen you always, everything I listen, because I feel a lot of peace with your teachings, with the teachings. The thing is, I am talking from Portugal, and I am thinking of going to your retreat in January, because I had a dream. You appeared in my dream, I believed. And in the dream, you said that I should go to India. And I was impressed by that. I don't know if that's like imagination of just a dream or if you really entered my dream. The thing is that I am thinking of going to the retreat and I am arranging things with a friend to go. That's what I would like to comment.
That's interesting for me too, because I rarely use the word should and tell people what they should and shouldn't do. But since it has happened, and if you feel like coming to India, all you can do is try. If it's meant to happen, it'll happen.
Yes, it was very good. I felt a lot of peace when I had that dream.
I do have, you know, in the past had things come to me in dreams. And then it's very strange. Dreams have taken me to certain places I would never have dreamt of visiting. At least consciously, you know, I have had certain dreams, let's say of a certain temple. And I was not ever a person to visit temples as such in my younger days. But then I found that when I
when I said, all right, this dream has come and let's see whether I need to make a visit for whatever reason, God only knows, I found it was all being organized very efficiently for me. You see, that actually took me by surprise, that things fell into place and somehow I landed up there. It's not that I had any tremendous experience or there was lightning going through me or anything, but I said, all right, I am here because I was meant to be here, and for whatever I'm supposed to receive, I'm here. No expectation. So in that sense, that's how it has happened for me as well.
I see. Thank you.
Thank you. Amazing. This is the living dream of life, you see. Life here today, gone tomorrow. And all content of life is so time-bound. What we considered precious 10 years ago, 5 years ago, no longer precious now, perhaps. Something has replaced it. Something else has become precious. It keeps changing. Everything is so transient. Everything is like shifting sands. And yet, I have seen it all. Since my first birthday till whatever age I am, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, that has seen through all the ups and downs in life. That one constant has seen it all, has seen what moments created happy memories, what moments created sad memories. And then God gives us the gift of deep sleep. Nobody is excluded from that as such. When we realize that our sleep was deep because we didn't exist as a separate ego in deep sleep, that is why my teacher would say that if we truly understood that death was nothing but a long, deep sleep, perhaps we would not be as afraid of it as we are. And with this teaching, what happens? It brings about the death of the ego with its sense of personal doership. This death allows one to navigate the waters of life, what happens to us, so to speak, in a gentler way. As Rameshji would say, it is far easier to swim with the current of life rather than against it. We start living this understanding more and more, that if we find we are fighting too much with circumstances and situations in our life, with people in our life, that is disturbing our peace of mind and others' peace of mind too. That is why I think I mentioned this in the Bangalore talk. I don't remember now. Khinch liya so rakt barabar. Khinch liya so rakt barabar. What you snatch or take is like getting blood, is not only referring to an object, like I'm taking someone's money or whatever. We are even snatching away people's peace of mind. What about that? How do you feel when your peace of mind is taken away from you, but we are only concerned with our precious peace of mind? We don't care about the other's peace of mind generally. So with this approach, you find that your obsession with me and my story starts disintegrating. And when you find this disintegrating, you'll be surprised to find that when you are meeting people, you are more and more available for them. When you find, suppose there's someone in your life you've been trying to correct all the time, could be a parent, sibling, child, or friend, and you meet this person tomorrow, and you look at this person and say, my God, this person is precisely the way God made them. And my need, and compulsive need rather, to try and change this person, to make this person better, when that need is no longer arising, I am meeting this person for who they are. Whether I like them or not is a different matter. Whether I agree or not is a different matter. And so, by and by, I find that I am letting go of the bondage of relationships, Rinanubandhan, which loosely translates as the cosmic debt of relationships. I am setting people free, and in the process, I am setting myself free. And then I get even more surprised when I find that I'm more and more at peace than I used to be, that some people are perhaps drawn to that peace. Maybe strangers, it could be anything. Someone in a shopping mall, in a restaurant, sitting at the next table. Because after all, we are all bundles of vibrations, vibrating at different frequencies. And that is why we get drawn to sages, for the degree of peace we feel in their presence, because we know that we are accepted there without judgment. So we find that this changes, our vibration changes, the people around us change, the circumstances start shifting, because we are not perpetuating like we were habitually, old patterns, old knee-jerk reactions, old trigger points, so that when we know, perhaps our last days have come, if we are able to know that, we thank everyone, all encounters, all relationships, that I learned something from everything. Thank you for showing me aspects of myself. Thank you for making me understand what life is about, the light and the shadow, and gratitude to one and all for teaching me whatever was meant to be taught. And thus, we are at peace when the curtain comes down, rather than full of hatred, malice, jealousy, envy, pride, arrogance, guilt, shame, condemnation, blame, and so on and so forth. We understand everyone has been assigned a role, just like a game of chess. Some are pawns, some are knights, some are bishops, someone is the queen, someone is the king. And my game of life is played on the chessboard of duality of every conceivable kind. But whether I am black, whether I am white, whether I win, whether I lose, is all really irrelevant, because now I know that everyone on the chessboard of my life was moved by a higher power. And more importantly, at the end of this game, this Leela, we are all going into the same box. I will just change my view so I can see all of you. Thank you.